Broken education systems.
Uno.
One in every six Europeans has mental health problems, not just young people, but also older people connected to loneliness and isolation. For example, every European with mental health issues has a right to access help mechanisms.
It's a right, but experts say help is often unavailable. Apparently, there's a need to prioritize funding.
We have debts and deficits, so the challenge really is how to reconcile this continuous pressure on public budgets, which health is placing, with the broader macroeconomic context.
It is being suggested that allowing young people to fall through the cracks while focusing all resources on the war in Ukraine threatens the future of the entire EU project. According to campaign groups advocating for the rights of young people, the inability of the political establishment in the EU to bring about job opportunities is translating into growing support for extreme anti-EU political parties. It's thought this disquiet will become clearly evident in 9 months from now, when a record number of Eurosceptic candidates are forecast to be successful during European Parliament elections. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After years of negotiations, the European Commission has finally taken a position on the migrant issue, the harshest one. Brussels will in fact back the Italian far-right government's hardline stance on migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has welcomed a 10-point plan on migrants presented by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Lampedusa on Sunday.
I'm confident the issue of migration will be added to the agenda of the next EU summit in October. We must stop departures from Africa and swiftly deport those turned down for asylum. The future of Europe is at stake here.
Following a surge in migrant arrivals on Italy's shores, von der Leyen visited the southern island of Lampedusa on Sunday, where the situation has been tense since the start of the year, with thousands of migrants stranded in difficult conditions. Here, von der Leyen announced a new migrant action plan, which includes fighting trafficking, returning migrants to the countries of origin, and transferring migrants from Italy to other EU member states.
It is very important for me because irregular migration is a European challenge and it needs a European answer. So we are in this together.
Germany has promptly expressed its support for another proposal made by the European Commission President von der Leyen that concerns expanding air and naval surveillance of the European Union's external borders. Some experts are of the idea that such a measure would be against international maritime law, as EU ships would not be allowed to operate in territorial zones where only North African states have jurisdiction.
Air and naval surveillance of the Mediterranean by the EU would be equivalent to a warlike act. We all know what has happened to Libya after the French-led NATO attack there. All migrants' countries of origin must be involved in a more democratic process of handling the migrants. Also, von der Leyen's 10-point plan on migrants is full of inconsistencies.
Meanwhile, French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin made a lightning visit to Italy on Monday. In an interview to a French radio, Darmanin said that France is willing to help Italy to secure its borders, but it will not take in any migrants from the island of Lampedusa. Max Civili, Rome.
Sports is one of the fields that has made significant progress after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and today Iranian athletes shine in different international competitions. In terms of the number of medals, the 2012 Olympics in London was unprecedented for Iranians after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iran left London with a total of 13 medals, 7 gold, 5 silver and 1 bronze, finishing 12th in the overall medal standings. But undoubtedly, Iran's national wrestling team has always brought colorful medals back home. And now, as the World Wrestling Championships is underway in Belgrade, Iran has already won 1 gold medal in the freestyle category. Greco-Roman wrestlers are well prepared for the World Championships, as well as the Asian Games due in China's Hangzhou City.
We are very much prepared for the Belgrade World Championships. All the teammates are at the peak of their preparedness. After the Belgrade Championships, we have the Asian Games in Hangzhou ahead. I'm very much motivated and hopeful.
I've been a member of the national team for about 8 years now. I have a number of world and Asian medals. I'm quite ready for the Belgrade competitions.
Our Greco-Roman wrestling team is at its utmost readiness for the World Championship in Belgrade. The Belgrade event is of great importance because the medalists will be given the ticket for the Olympic Games. We are very much hopeful about winning medals.
Iranian athletes and especially wrestlers practice hard to get prepared for securing top places at global competitions, despite all the limitations which are imposed against Iran and Iranian national teams.
Also at junior level, Iran's national wrestling team has a good record to the extent that back in early August 2023, Iran's national junior Greco-Roman wrestling team ranked first in World Championships in Istanbul, winning one gold, one silver and two bronze medals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
One month after reaching a deal mediated by Qatar, the U.S. and Iran each released five prisoners sought by the other. The five U.S. detainees left Tehran aboard a Qatari plane for Doha, en route to their country. All were arrested on charges of espionage and collaborating with foreign governments. The U.S. citizens freed include Siam Aknamazi, Emma Charghi, and Murad Tahbaz. The identities of the other two have not been disclosed. The five Iranian prisoners were identified as Mehrdad Moin Ansari, Kambiz Attar Kashani, Reza Sarhangpur Kofrani, Amin Hassanzadeh, and Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi. They were held in American jails illegally under the pretext of violating U.S. sanctions.
After a successful teamwork, five innocent Iranians held in U.S. prisons were freed today. Two of them are on the way to Tehran via Doha. Iran's Human Rights Council is determined to uphold the rights of Iranian nationals abroad in cooperation with the executive and judiciary powers.
Tehran has repeatedly urged Washington to release innocent Iranian nationals who have been taken hostage on baseless charges of bypassing U.S. sanctions, decrying Washington for tying the humanitarian issue with other issues, including the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
I mean, this is a type of blackmailing, you know, this is kind of like mafia work, but, you know, within a government, and this is what the U.S. does, right? They arrest people, they put, you know, unjust charges, they fabricate charges. And this is their way of trying to bully the Islamic Republic of Iran and weaken them. But the Islamic Republic of Iran, thankfully with their leadership and the supreme leader, they're not giving in and they're not bowing down and they're not being submissive and they're fighting for their rights.
A few minutes after the release of the prisoners, U.S. President Joe Biden slapped fresh sanctions on Iran, sending a message of continued enmity towards the Islamic Republic. The sanctions on Iran's intelligence ministry and former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad were imposed over the alleged disappearance of Bob Levinson, a former FBI agent. Levinson reportedly visited Iran's southern Kish Island on March 2007. He later went missing and his whereabouts have remained unknown ever since. Tehran and Washington have many unresolved issues which lay barriers in their ties, such as the heavy unilateral sanctions imposed unjustly by the U.S. Iran has time and again expressed readiness to put aside differences and resolve issues via diplomatic ways, such as this case.
The health ministry in Gaza Strip says that the lives of hundreds of kidney failure patients are at risk due to lack of medicine and special chemicals needed for dialysis machines. Most kidney patients are hospitalized in the territory's biggest medical center, the Shifa Hospital. The hospital, just like other health facilities in Gaza, has been struggling with severe shortage of basic supplies for several years under the Israeli blockade. This has hit the patients with chronic diseases, including renal failure, the hardest, and children are no exception.
Kidney failure patients in Gaza Strip are amounting to 1,100. These patients, usually every one of them will make dialysis three times per week in different hospitals of Gaza Strip. Among those 1,100, we have 38 children. So without having those dialysis every week, three times, they will certainly succumb to their life and they will die.
The lives of kidney failure patients depend on dialysis machines, but they usually malfunction due to overuse and lack of spare parts for repairs.
I need kidney dialysis three times a week, and I suffer from various illnesses. Dozens of medicines are nowhere to be found in Gaza's hospitals. The situation is very dangerous, and not having the treatment is a death sentence to kidney patients.
Death and suffering for Palestinians have always been what has come out of Israel's policy of keeping almost every necessity under scarcity in the Gaza Strip. And the health system has been no exception.
Today, this crisis is very acute now. I think this is the top urgent crisis we're facing in Gaza Strip today. And as you know, every now and then, the Israelis are still waving to attack Gaza once again. So the situation is very hard, complicated. And humanitarian issues, including health sector, should be avoided from all those punishment to the Palestinian people, because the patients will pay their lives.
What makes things worse for Palestinians is the fact that the international community remain apathetic to their plight.
Gazans have been facing difficulties in receiving medical care since 2007. The Ministry of Health blames the Israeli blockade for the endless suffering, especially among chronically ill patients. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
From breaking world records to bringing home gold medals for the first time.
Dream of elation for the Iranian nation. Nahid Kiani, world champion.
Iranian female athletes have been making their mark in the world, from team sports such as futsal and hockey to fencing and canoeing. For these young ladies, sky is the limit.
Over the past 2 years, the administration has worked hard to promote women's sports. That is why our sportswomen have been able to win over 1,300 medals in international tournaments, outnumbering the number of medals earned by male athletes.
Today, the number of female athletes in Iran is greater than that of males in the top 13 sports disciplines, including martial arts, particularly taekwondo, and also track and field, with a number of trailblazers making it possible for a new generation of Muslim girls to join in.
The presence of Iranian female athletes is not just significant in terms of their capabilities. More important than that is their presence on an international level promoting Islamic values. These young ladies are trailblazers that lead the way for sportswomen from other Muslim countries to take part in international events.
Words that were echoed by Iran's president in a meeting with athletes that will soon be off to Hangzhou, China, to take part in the 19th Asian Games.
I always emphasize that we should pay special attention to sports for all members of our society, particularly women. These young ladies are cultural ambassadors that demonstrate to the whole world that our values don't contradict a strong presence in sports events.
Over the past 2 years only, Iranian female athletes have been able to win more than 1,380 colorful medals in different fields, collecting bronze, silver, and gold medals, and making Iranians proud.
And now with this amazing record, Iranian women athletes are off to China to make history in the Asian Games. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Pakistan has been facing an acute energy crisis for many years. To overcome the energy needs of the country, a national energy conference was organized in Islamabad to explore ways to handle the energy supply deficiency. The conference was attended by energy experts, economists, traders, and political activists. The business community expressed its serious concerns over growing energy deficit in the country, demanding the government to defy the U.S. requests and move to import cheaper electricity and gas supplies from neighboring countries, especially Iran.
We have an abundant resource of energy next door, but due to international political pressures, we are unable to tap that resource, which will be good for our economy plus the economy of our neighbor.
Analysts say the energy crisis poses serious threats to Pakistan's fragile economy and national security environment, urging the government to further strengthen economic ties with Tehran.
Yes, the option is very nice. And we have no other chance other than to connect our all gas-fired power plant with the Iranian gas plant, with the Iranian gas pipeline. And that is already terminated at the border.
Allah has blessed us with the abundant renewable resources. And if we decide that, okay, we have to go for it, okay, like our neighbors are doing it, okay, in only 5 years, okay, we can go for 100% renewable energy. It's not a big deal.
Meanwhile, talking to Press TV, Iran's ambassador to Pakistan reiterated that Tehran is ready to help Islamabad meet its energy needs. He said closer energy partnership between the two countries can strengthen their bilateral relations and promote regional stability.
We know that the Pakistani people are in dire need of energy and we are ready to provide cheaper gas supplies to Pakistan.
Political activists say Pakistan's decision to import cheaper energy supplies from neighboring Iran would offer a promising avenue towards greater economic growth, energy security, and environmental sustainability.
Expanding energy trade with Iran will not only foster economic and diplomatic ties between Islamabad and Tehran, but will also help Pakistan to modernize its infrastructure and harness its energy potential more effectively. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The rising cost of living is forcing British households to reassess their budgets and cut back to make ends meet. Food inflation remains high in Britain, and the price of basic items has risen significantly. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Campaigners said the cost of some basic food items such as cheese, butter and bread has soared by more than 30% in the last 2 years, forcing poorer households to make desperate choices between keeping up with their bill payments or putting food on the table. According to research by Consumer Body, which shared exclusively with The Guardian, food price inflation has slowed in recent months, but costs remain much higher than they were 2 years ago, disproportionately affecting low-income families. According to the latest analysis by retail industry data provider Kantar, the annual pace of grocery price growth cooled to 14.9% over the 4 weeks to 9th of July, down from 16.5% a month earlier. Despite the slowdown, which figures showed that food prices have risen significantly over the past 2 years, and some products have gone up by as much as 30% since 2021. The food products with the highest rate of inflation are milk, with 36.4%, cheese, with 35.2%, butter and spreads with 32.2%, cakes and cookies with 31.2%, and bakery items with 30.3%. Vegetable prices are up 19.1% since May to July of 2021. Meat prices are up by 23.6%, and savory pies and pastries and quiches are up 26.2%. Biscuit prices have increased by 27%, and fruit juice and drinks and smoothies are up 28.6%. The Consumer Rights Group is urging supermarkets to stock their cheapest products in their convenience store branches, as well as larger outlets, as charities warned that families were struggling to cope with food inflation. Richard Lane, Director of External Affairs at debt charity Step Change, said, "The rising cost of living is forcing households to reassess their budgets and cut back to make ends meet. Food inflation remains high and has pushed the price of basic items up significantly." Richard Lane added, "These rises are hitting the poorest the hardest, and it creates a poverty premium where those on tighter budgets are unable to save by buying in bulk and end up spending more money on food and essentials as they shop little and often." He added, "As food costs continue to rise, the knock-on effect can be felt elsewhere, with people having to make desperate choices between keeping up their bills or putting food on the table." Website Reddit has also covered the same story. A recent research by Step Change debt charity found 1 in 7 people in Britain had recently skipped meals or gone without a healthy diet in order to keep up with credit repayments, rising to nearly 1 in 3 for those on universal credit. Helen Barnard, Director of Policy, Research and Impact at the Trussell Trust, the Food Bank Network, said, "Inflation is hitting those on the lowest income hardest, with the cost of essentials like food and energy, which account for far more of their budget than is the case for people on higher incomes, rising especially steeply." Helen Barnard added, "The last year, the food banks in its network experienced higher levels of need than ever before, distributing among 3 million parcels to people who could not afford essentials." She said, "Donations also increased, reflecting the public's greater generosity, even at a time of increased financial pressure for many, but rising need outpaced donations. This led to food banks having to purchase 124% more food than they did the previous year, at a time when prices are higher than ever, putting a significant strain on their operating costs." Which has called on grocers to make affordable and healthy basic food ranges available across all of their stores to ensure that offers and promotions are used to support those who are struggling and are targeted at healthy foods, and to make sure their pricing is clear so that shoppers can easily work out what offers the best value. It welcomed an announcement by Tesco on Friday, 11th of August, that the retailer would be introducing cheaper own brand range items in its convenience stores, but said more needed to be done, putting out that own brand items are still more expensive than budget ranges. For example, Tesco's own brand penne pasta is 75 pence for 500 grams, but its budget version is 41 pence. Sue Davies, head of food policy at Which, said, "Despite well-advertised price cuts, Which Tracker shows that the cost of essentials like milk and butter is still very high and piling huge pressure on millions of people, which is why access to budget ranges is more important than ever to help people save money." Sky News has also reported on the same story. The cost of sustenance in the United Kingdom could still remain higher than it was before Ukraine war caused the rate of food price rises to accelerate. Hugh Peel, the Bank of England's chief economist, said, unfortunately, the days of seeing food prices fall, that does seem to be something that we may not be seeing for a little while yet, if at all in the future. Speaking at a question and answer session on the cost of living, Hugh Peel said, even if the rate of food inflation slows down, food will still be more expensive than it had been, with the effects of food inflation going to take longer to dissipate. Official figures show food inflation stood at 17.3% in the 12 months up to June, when the overall consumer price index measure of inflation was 7.9%. Britain has been particularly impacted by rising food prices. Hugh Peel said that impact on food prices in the United Kingdom has been a little bit more long-lasting than would have been expected on the back of past behaviour. He placed the blame at the Russia-Ukraine war, which scrambled the supply chain of staple grown in Ukraine, such as wheat and sunflower oil, and brought up costs of raw materials and basic food items. Hugh Peel said one explanation for why the United Kingdom has been hit hard by this is UK companies responded to the price uncertainty in the wake of the Ukraine conflict by locking in expensive contracts. He said some firms decided to sort of lock in their purchases of commodities in international markets in order to reduce that uncertainty, but potentially locked in at quite high levels of prices, and they're still passing that through the system into what ultimately we're paying for in shops. Hugh Peel added, price rises will begin to slow as those contracts come to an end and food sub-processors in the United Kingdom adjust to the end of supply disruption.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian president has attended the 78th UN General Assembly in New York. His message, peace, justice, confronting discrimination and domination, unilateralism and terrorism, and the West supporting terrorist groups, amongst others. He also mentioned that a new world order was taking shape across the globe, which will remain irreversible. Which countries are against this new world order? Why are the U.S. and its European allies accusing Iran, Russia, and China of endangering the world order? In this edition of the program, we will look at why the world will not accept the Western hegemony and Cold War mentality any longer. First, let me introduce our guest. Hakimeh Sarayberia is an academic and political analyst who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us is Daniel Jedish, author and researcher of Trans Intifada, the Politics and Poetics of Intersectional Resistance, who joins us from Beirut. All right, welcome to you both. If I may start with you, Hakimeh, and ask you about, and we're going to get right to the point here about what Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has said, but I'd like, if possible, for both of our guests to mention some real-time examples. For example, when Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said that Americanization has failed, and he called it a project, and the quote, I'm going to quote him, the world is irreversibly transitioning into a new order. The Western domination equation does not work for the world anymore. Can you explain to us what he means by that, Hakimeh, if you can, and maybe provide an example, if it's possible?
Yes, we could say that we are at the end of an era that we could say is the westernization of the world, the end of which was the Americanization of the world. Project inside a bigger project. The worldwide project of colonization started in 1492 when the New World, so-called New World, was found by Christoph Columbus. And of course, after that, we entered an era in which Western powers not only tried to colonize the world and exploit the world, but also tried to impose a cultural way of looking at human beings, which was looking at humanity in terms of a hierarchy, in which Western powers, Western culture in general, is seen as superior, and the rest are seen as inferior to the West. And of course, as I said, the last part of this project has been the Americanization of the world, which started basically after World War II, in which we had two world powers, so-called two poles in the world. One was the Eastern Bloc, the Eastern Pole, which was the Soviet Union, and then the United States. And after the demise of the Soviet Union, we were left with a world in which the United States felt as the sole superpower, and in which it could rule over the whole of the globe. But that project came to a lot of problems, especially after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, because this was a place where American hegemony was at its height. We had one of the most Americanized governments in the world here in Iran, with the government of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, in which the United States basically ruled. He was basically, as he said, he was the gendarme of the region, in which he was the person, and his government actually was the entity in which with which the United States used to safeguard its interests in the region. So that era is coming to an end. And what attests to that is the failure of U.S. policy, in the region, and also, the will of the people all over the world to come out of that sort of mentality and that sort of system.
So, Daniel Yejic, if that's the case, when it comes to the issue of this polarity in the world, one would think that there's polarity that exists in the world now, even if we're talking about the U.S. on the decline, which is one of the things that Ibrahim Raisi has actually spoke against, where he said that there shouldn't be this polarity. He said basically that Iran maintains the formation of a new East-West divide should not be permitted for this to take place. And what's more alarming is that he said the reason for that is making trade corridors unsafe, diminishing countries from allies to dependents, and stifling economic progress of sovereign nations. How could that be endangered? If you can give us some examples, if you agree with what the Iranian president has said there.
Absolutely. I think what we've seen in the past, especially maybe even in the past weeks and months, unfold is very clear examples of a move towards a multipolar world order. And as we've seen, the United States has obviously, due to its colonial and imperialist roots and the way in which its foreign policy has been implemented, has been depending on violence, and with all different forms of violence, including political violence, warfare, to an extent, to keep this the unequal global distribution of political power alive, which at the center had the U.S. hegemony, which was also obviously guarded by its close proxies and allies, including the EU and NATO. But obviously, this cannot be sustained to that extent anymore. And as we've seen, obviously, Iran being one of the examples with the Iranian Revolution, and now over four decades of sanctions and regime change attempts and different forms of political coercion, and also all sorts of political and media discourse, imperialist media discourse, that have been trying to weaken Iran. I'm just using Iran as an example. There are many other examples in the global south and the third world that we can cite as victims of U.S. sanctions and different forms of global warfare. And in the end, again, this sort of perpetuation of this hegemony has required violence. And I think Palestine and the Zionist colony and this apartheid regime that has been constructed there based on ethnic cleansing is another example of how this colonial mentality of superiority and supremacy requires perpetual warfare. But we are at a point where there have been moves towards a multipolar world order where the United States has, in particular in Western Asia, seen its power declined, particularly in the past years, not just politically, but also if we think in terms of military and economic advance.
Well, then let's, since you mentioned the Zionist regime or Israel, Ms. Hakimi-Abir, let me ask you about how the destructive role that that plays in this region, the West Asia region, of which we know that this region, after experiencing such turbulent times, to say the least, is transforming itself into being uniform in terms of all the countries being united. There's only one entity that stands out here is, according to the way I see it, the Israeli regime. From the outside looking in, is it that hard to see that they are a source of instability, putting aside at this point how it's rupturing from within in terms of what they used to preach was the only democracy in the region, and we can see what they're talking about is falling apart within their own entity?
What we are witnessing today is actually the coming apart of the propaganda of the Zionist regime and its supporters, the United States and other Western powers, that the Zionist regime is the only democracy in the region. As we move along and as the true nature of the Zionist regime, which is a settler colonial state, not only an apartheid state, but a settler colonial state that interestingly is built upon the structures and the systems that were once experimented in the United States, the very idea of settlements, of removing the natives of a region. These were all experimented in the United States. And then, the last such project in the world has been the Zionist project, implementing in this region a settler colonial state whose goal is the removal of the Palestinians, if not physically, at least culturally and, spiritually, in terms of a people that are there, that have rights, that can have a state of their own. So at this juncture, there is no one in the world, Western, Eastern, or anyone, who believes that the Zionist regime is there and is ready to give the Palestinians any rights in terms of a state of their own. So the two-state solution is dead. More and more people, more and more of the elites, foreign policy elites in Western countries, including the United States, are coming to the realization that this is an apartheid regime that no longer can be, hidden under the veil of propaganda, and that more and more people are coming to this realization that this is not an entity that can be supported by any, logic, especially, within the liberal mentality and, way of thinking. So this is going to be, we are actually witnessing a time that we are approaching the demise of Zionism as a sort of political philosophy or, way of thinking. And this is going to happen when more and more people, especially in the Western countries, are going to back away from supporting this regime. When we come to the point that the Zionist regime is no longer there in terms of what it stands for, then I think one of the main sources of instability in the region is going to be removed, and we are going to be in a state where the people of the region can build structures of power that are basically centered around justice and equality and shared interests.
This is what's so incredible, and correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel Yejish, the extreme perspectives of reality of which the U.S. sees it one way, and now many countries are seeing it another way. They have awakened, in a sense. And I'm going to go back to the year 2021 when the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken called China the most serious long-term threat to the world order. And then recently he said the Cold War mentality, fanning the flames of conflict, that's over. He said that this means the measure is reactionary and does disservice to nations' security and welfare. I'm trying to understand how it is that the U.S. looks at it through its lens, that it's the one that should maintain the world order, when the new world order has left the U.S. ideologies behind. Just in terms of one example I like to use in terms of security, the late Qasem Soleimani, Iran's lieutenant general, who was at the forefront of fighting terrorism, was labeled to be the opposite by the U.S., but yet it was fighting the terrorists. So we can see the schisms involved in the way that the U.S. is trying to portray that reality to the world. Of course, you're more than welcome to use other examples.
Yeah, and I think we see here when we go back to the entire discourse, I mean, even the ways in which these words such as terrorism and democracy are used are, of course, very biased in different ways and oftentimes structured around the comfort of those who are in power. And if we still look, again, at the past decades, the United States has, to some extent, have enjoyed a role where it is the only sole superpower in the world due to, obviously, its military power, economically, politically, and obviously having proxies and client states in different parts of the world. And so if we look at what you mentioned initially, this view on China, identifying China as a threat, we can list Iran, Russia, a lot of other examples of nations or governments that were identified as threats. And in this case, threats to this Western Eurocentric and in fact very white supremacist structure of domination. So these threats again go back to this very white and Western Eurocentric lens. And then when it comes to situations, as you mentioned, with obviously not fighting against terrorism in the region, but having a very strong military presence for so many years, which has caused problems in many ways of structural nature, including beyond sanctions, including economic problems in the regions and leaving entire regions devastated. So of course, it is again structured around those insecurities that not only the United States, but we could also see how Europe is experiencing that in the context of the Russia-Ukraine war. Situations that show us this move towards the multipolar world order, because in the end, it is a minority. If we look at the European Union as an extension of the United States, it is in fact then a small minority of the world's population that has for so long held the majority power when it comes to decision-making and military intervention.
There's a selective approach, Ms. Hakimi-Abiera, that Ibrahim Raisi has talked about when it comes to terrorism. And he did mention Europe, since our guest there, Daniel Yejish, talked about Europe, that some European countries, he said, despite claiming to fight terrorism, they're actually harboring terrorist groups like the MKO, of which we know very well know how they're responsible for the murder of 17,000 Iranians. Why is it that they preach one line and yet act in another way? Why do they not see that this particular hosting of this terrorist cult really is wrong? What does that say from their inner thinking?
I think the motto is that the end justifies the means. Basically, that is the liberal way of looking at politics. And that is that has created problems over and over for Western powers. Of course, in the short run, they use any means that are available to them and seems to be working, including the use of terrorists, if that be. They have used that during the war in Afghanistan when the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. The CIA was the one that actually funded Al-Qaeda and created the problem of terrorism there. Later on, when we had the war between the Ba'ath regime of Saddam Hussein and Iran, it was these very, you know, European countries and the United States that aided Saddam in doing all sorts of terroristic actions against a whole people, including the use of chemical weapons, in which, you know, the Germans, for example, gave him the means to do so. And of course, the other countries involved also did many atrocities in terms of arming Saddam, in terms of, for example, the United States giving him, helping him in terms of intelligence and, you know, other political support for him. And then, of course, after that, we have seen what the United States has done in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the, you know, in creating the problem of Daesh there, ISIS, basically, and then standing in the way of those in the region, including General Soleimani, you know, being at the forefront of this fight against terrorism, of fighting the ISIS, you know, terroristic entity. So these are, all of this shows that there's a problem in the liberal way of looking at politics, which is, you know, the end justifies the means. The what is missing here is a moral way of looking at things. What is the right, you know, is not always pursued. It is what makes sense in terms of, you know, instrumentally, you know, look, even the people of the region become means to the end that is, you know, the having hegemony over the region and all those, you know, interests that are there. Sure. So I think that would encapsulate what the problem is.
You know, there might be some people, Daniel Yeager, looking at watching this program, I don't know, from somewhere in the world, maybe from the U.S., maybe in Asia somewhere. And they might not be familiar and think what are they saying when they say new world order, or when they talk about the world is in a transition. I mean, some of the answers that in my mind that I can point towards that is to mention, for example, BRICS, how these countries have united and how prevalent that has become as an organization, where there's so many countries that want to join it now. Or when you take a look at Africa, for example, of course you could name some examples. Taking a look at some of the countries in West Africa and Central Africa that have risen up against colonialism. These are the former colonies of France. Don't these constitute new world order dimensions that Ebrahim Raisi and many others have been talking about?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of potential here for reconfigurations of this world order. And as you mentioned, what we see currently taking place in parts of Western Africa is just another example of the undoing of French colonialism. To just name France as another example of a country has been exploiting resources from Africa and other parts of the world for centuries. We can just name Algeria as an example of 1.5 centuries under a brutal French occupation and colonization that was perpetuated through a political discourse of France about alleged what France had referred to as civilization and secularism. And examples are many, particularly of France in Africa. And again, this goes back centuries of unequal power structures in which the white West was able to dominate the vast majority of the world, exploit their resources. And still today, we have a situation where Europe and the EU leaders claim that they are some sort of garden and the rest of the world is a jungle. And again, all of these privileges and the access that Europeans have can be traced back to those colonial genocides and the exploitation of the rest of the world. And then if we look at, let's say, the last 3 decades, there was to some extent a unipolar world order where the United States did have a significant amount of power. But also this is a limited era in time, because just remind ourselves, there was a time when there was a non-aligned movement, where there was a South-South cooperation, and it's always continued to be very visibly. And I think what we've seen with the expansion of BRICS, for example, is just another indication that there is an increased and more open cooperation between the South that circumvents those Western orders, because in the end, a lot of Western diplomacy is one-sided. It's unilateral, it's transactional, whereas a lot of what we see happening in the global south these days is based on shared solidarity, shared experiences, and cooperation rather than exploitation. And I think this is one of the key issues where there is a particular potential for this reconfiguration of the world order, not only away from the United States and Europe at the center, but also away from colonial structures, exploitation, and dehumanization towards maybe a more differently or more equally distributed power.
I spoke to an analyst earlier in one of our news segments, Ms. Hakim Abiria, and he was very happy. He was a Muslim, and he was very happy and ecstatic that the Iranian president had brought up the issue of the desecration of the Holy Quran, because basically it was representative of Muslims in a sense, and of course what that represents to Muslims. But what's alarming here is one of the statements that Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said, that there's a bigger design behind these instances of hate mongering, I'm quoting him, and relegating them to the freedom of speech is misleading. But what is the bigger design behind these types of acts? It makes it sound like these are pre-planned acts by Western governments that they're trying to demonize Islam and Muslims, which, of course, we've seen that happen throughout the years and decades.
I think what is there, what is the design that is there is, you know, working against some of the trends that we are seeing, we are witnessing in the world. One of the trends is the attraction that many of the peoples who have been under exploitation over the years to the concepts that are there in Quran, in the Quran, and of course the attraction of Islam in general. So we are seeing this sort of trend of the growth of Islam, you know, throughout the world, especially in in the West. So, and that is because of the attraction of the very concepts that are there in the Quran. That, you know, the Iranian president, Mr. Ebrahim Raisi, correctly mentioned that there are three central concepts. One is the unity of God, monotheism, tawhid. The other is justice. And then, of course, he mentioned a third one. If I'm not mistaken, he was talking about the unity of the human beings. Please correct me if I'm not looking.
No, you're saying it correctly. That's it.
Yes. So this is very attractive to the people who have experienced, a structure of power that has been built around the idea that no, human beings are not equal. Humans are superior to others. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for your contribution, Hakim Yasser Abiria, academic and political analyst from Tehran. And thank you, Daniel Yejic. He's the author and researcher of Trans Intifada, the Politics and Poetics of Intersectional Resistance from Beirut. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitale and the team. Bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic